Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, October 7th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Trump administration renting space for federal operations in 20 cities nationwide, 19 of them Democratic cities, including Spokane and Boise. Third in a series of interviews with Moscow City Council candidates, this time with Sage Mukhedich. Moscow Council adjusts light duty hours and addresses summer hours for city employees at city council meeting, and Idaho legislature intervenes in taxpayer money for private and religious schools lawsuit. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho Supreme Court has agreed to let the Idaho legislature intervene in the case against House Bill 93, the new law requiring taxpayers to pay for private and religious schools. The court denied another motion to intervene filed by two right-wing nationwide private school organizations last week. The Moscow School District, some Idaho parents, and some Idaho education groups have sued the state over House Bill 93, saying it violates the clause in the Idaho Constitution that says the legislature shall provide a thorough system of free public schools, among other things. The Idaho Attorney General's office is representing the state and specifically the Idaho Department of Commerce in the case. The Idaho Education News reports House Speaker Mike Moyle of Star and Senate President Pro Tem Kelly Anthem of Burley hired the private Boise law firm Givens Persley to represent the legislature. Moyle said the reason the legislature needs to intervene is to make sure, quote, all the information gets out there. The House Speaker said the Attorney General's office sometimes misses stuff. He said, we want to be involved since we passed it. I wish we didn't have to go through a lawsuit on this, but hopefully we can get it resolved soon and move on. The lawsuit seeks to block the $50 million tax credit program for families wealthy enough to send their children to private schools. The program would offer $5,000 per student tax breaks to parents who send their children to private schools. Opponents say that's not enough to fully cover tuition at most private schools.
This week is Banned Books Week, and it comes at a time when the battle over free speech is increasing across the country. Libraries in Idaho and other states are at the center of this fight. Book banning has increased in recent years, most often targeting works that include the LGBTQ community and people of color. In Idaho, lawmakers passed House Bill 710 last year, which requires libraries to segregate material deemed harmful to children or face legal action. Sherry Shaline is director of the Donnelly Public Library in rural central Idaho. She says book banning is hard on remote libraries like hers.
When the government puts constraints on what you can and cannot read, librarians have a difficult time doing their job effectively, especially rural and small libraries.
Donnelly Public Library joined a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of House Bill 710. Authors and book publishers have also joined the suit. Dan Novak is Associate General Counsel for Penguin Random House, which is part of the legal challenge. He says Shaline's library had to go to absurd lengths to comply with the law.
Rather than risk enforcement, which would be incredibly punitive, the Donnelly Public Library cannot afford to even defend itself against an enforcement action, let alone pay penalties. They decided to go adults only. So kids aren't allowed inside. And honestly, it's a tragedy.
Shaline says libraries provide vital services, especially in remote communities like hers that are far from urban areas.
Those libraries are stepping up and they're offering telehealth. They're offering community service programs. They're offering after-school programs. Libraries across the United States are stepping up and offering things that are not offered anywhere else in the community.
Support for this reporting was provided by the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Voting rights advocates are pushing back against an initiative to require voters to have enhanced driver's licenses or provide other proof of citizenship in order to vote in the state of Washington. Under the initiative, registered voters would be automatically unregistered in November of 2027 if they do not provide the required documents. Shomo Lahiri Gupta of the immigrant rights organization One America calls the initiative an attack on voting rights that would harm all Washingtonians.
Adding more and more requirements will create more and more hurdles to fulfill something that is designated as a right in the Constitution for all U.S. citizens. A right should not have hurdles. A right should be as easily accessible as possible.
State Republican Party Chair Jim Walsh filed the initiative in May. Washington Republicans say it is designed to implement a Trump executive order on election integrity, but that order has been blocked by courts and faces ongoing legal challenges. The current Washington voter registration form requires people to check a box confirming they are a citizen, but proponents of the initiative argue that is not enough. Cynthia Stewart with the League of Women Voters counters that the initiative is trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
There's no evidence that there are a lot of people who are not citizens who are registering to vote. It's a criminal penalty if they do lie about that.
Lahiri Gupta says Washington has been working to make elections more accessible through mail-in voting and same-day voter registration.
Washington needs to continue to be a leader, and this initiative sets us back decades.
The initiative needs about 309,000 signatures by January in order to advance. Lawmakers could then adopt the initiative as written or send it to voters in November of 2026. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Tonight we hold an awesome party, sir. One, two,
three, four. The KRFP 21st birthday party is coming up Saturday, October 11th. Live music from the pond. Plus bad karaoke.
Make it bad.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for a dime.
Gotta go off key now.
Hallelujah. Yeah.
Bring your most off-tune warble, your gruffest vocal fry, your favorite harmonized screams. They're all acceptable at KRFP's Bad Karaoke. That is, until someone pays $5 to make it stop.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day, you gave it away.
This time it'll be at Shattuck West at 630 North Almond Street.
Bad karaoke night. Jolene, 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 ow! Bad. Trump impersonation contest. Prizes to be announced.
Well, let's see how we say it.
21st birthday.
Starts at 7 p.m.
Saturday, October 11th.
The U.S. General Services Administration has issued competitive lease proposals for law enforcement office space in Spokane, Boise, and 19 other cities. The Spokesman Review reports the leases would be for fully furnished office space with 70 desks, a conference room, a storage room, a 24/7 server room, and sound privacy for confidential discussions. The lease proposal discourages co-location with any agencies or tenants that could have, quote, security, operational, or reputational conflicts with federal law enforcement. It requests 10-year leases and locations within municipal limits of the cities. 20 out of the 21 cities in the lease proposal request all voted for Kamala Harris in the last election. The exception is Naples, Florida. A General Services Administration spokesperson declined to disclose which federal law enforcement agencies would be occupying the spaces, but said they are moving forward on leases, quote, focused on supporting this administration's goal of optimizing the federal footprint and, quote, providing the best workplaces for our federal agencies to meet their mission. The cities where the lease proposals are sent include Birmingham, Charleston in Columbia, South Carolina, Columbus, Ohio, Des Moines, Iowa, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Louisville, Kentucky, Milwaukee, Oklahoma City, Pittsburgh, Raleigh, North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, St. Louis, Missouri, and Florida cities, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, Sunrise, Jacksonville, and Fort Myers, as well as Naples. The Trump administration had moved to increase the presence and operations of ICE. It's set to receive $76.5 billion to hire 10,000 more staff by the end of the year to meet its immigration deportation goals.
A new law clarifies the role of Washington State's tribes on local boards of health, granting each tribe a seat on their county's board and allowing them to appoint their own representative. The change clarifies a 2020 state law that requires local boards of health to include members who are not elected officials, including tribal representatives. Vicki Lowe is with the American Indian Health Commission, a nonprofit that works with the state to promote wellness in Washington's Native communities. She says the previous language was not clear about who was responsible for appointing tribal representatives to health boards or how many seats were available.
I'm hoping going forward we can get more tribes on these local boards of health and the local relationship and working together to keep all of our community healthy and safe will happen.
Every county in the state has a local board of health that is tasked with enforcing health laws, controlling infectious diseases, and setting local policies. Of Washington's 29 federally recognized tribes, Lowe says so far about 15 have appointed someone to their local board. Lowe says the 2020 law came about during the pandemic in order to make sure that tribes were involved with contact tracing and vaccine distribution.
During COVID, we really found out how important it was for those relationships locally where the tribes and the local health jurisdictions were working together.
Ashley Bell is the tribal liaison for the Washington State Board of Health. She says the new law respects and affirms tribal sovereignty and makes sure that tribes are a part of public health conversations.
They are a part of the community and really have a direct impact on how community health happens.
The Washington Board of Health is in the first stages of the rulemaking process for the new law, which includes getting public feedback and consulting with the state's tribes and urban Indian health organizations. Bell says they are hoping to be done next July. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
KRFP programming is sponsored by listeners like you and by Essential Art Gallery and Fine Gifts at 203 South Main Street in Moscow. Showcasing high-quality art, pottery, jewelry, art glass, sculptures, scarves, textiles, wood and metal art, and fine chocolate and gifts from regional, national, and international artists. KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
The study finds over 63,000 older Americans died by gun suicide from 2009 to 2023. Oregon has one of the country's highest rates of firearm suicide, with nearly 1,400 such deaths. Data journalist Aaron Mendelson says this trend is driven partly by the nation's growing population of older adults, which has nearly doubled in 20 years. He warns that without intervention, the problem will continue to worsen.
So we thought looking at the data and just starting from that point would be a good way to approach this subject. That is often really challenging to discuss, even though it happens far more than I think many people realize.
The data shows a sharp gender and racial disparity, with the highest gun suicide rates among white men over 70. Mendelson adds the rates are much higher in rural communities, which is true in Oregon as well. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Mendelson attributes the high rates of suicide among older white men in rural areas to several factors, including the greater mental health health stigma faced by their generation.
Factors like severe physical illness, pain, financial pressures, isolation, death of a spouse, a lack of mental health care, and the availability of firearms. These are all things that play a role.
There are a number of programs that Mendelson says could help. Oregon is part of the Gun Shop Project, a collaboration between the state, various organizations, and gun shops to raise awareness about the risks of firearm suicide. Other states have implemented Donna's Law, which allows people to put themselves on a list, making them temporarily unable to buy firearms. Mendelson adds the most important thing is to talk about it.
For the many tens, hundreds of thousands of folks who have had their lives touched by this issue, they're not alone. If we don't identify something as a problem, well, you can't begin to fix it.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
We now bring you the third in our series of interviews with Moscow City Council and Mayor candidates, an interview with Moscow City Council candidate Sage Makedich. This year, there are eight candidates running for three open seats on the Moscow City Council. They are Steve Bonner, Evan Holmes, Sage Makedich, Gary Skuland, John Slagboom, Ben Stellman, Scott Sumner, and incumbent Gina Tarusio. A ninth candidate, Robert Paul Fender, withdrew from the ballot. Three out of six city council positions are up for election this year, with the top three vote-getters in the eight-way race winning four-year terms. The council members whose terms are ending are Julia Parker, Haley Lewis, who is running for mayor, and Gina Tarusio, who is running for re-election to the council. City Council members Bryce Blankenship, Drew Davis, and Sandra Kelly have 2 years remaining in their terms. There are also two candidates running for Moscow mayor. They are current City Council member Haley Lewis and Charles Alex Simon, whose name on the ballot appears as Alex Simon. Today we have our interview with Moscow City Council candidate Sage Makedich. Recording now, and we're with Sage Makedich. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Makedich.
Makedich, okay. Sage Makedich, who is running for Moscow City Council, one of eight candidates running for three open seats. And first of all, why did you decide to run?
Yeah, good question. So I'm a lifelong Moscow resident, and I feel like Moscow has just always been very generous to me. Loved growing up here, grew up in the public school system. I was always really involved when I was in middle school and high school with several clubs and playing soccer, and always felt the need to be really engaged with others around me. And that continued into my time at U of I and now as a realtor for the past 10 years. I feel as though the community's been very generous to me. And I've spent a lot of time on various nonprofit boards over my lifetime here, especially over the last 10 years. But I feel like my run for city council is sort of the next big step in terms of how I can give back. So ultimately, that's why I'm running. Secondly, it's just because Moscow is my home and I care about it a lot.
And tell us a little bit about your background, what you do. It sounds like you're involved in real estate and also maybe some of the nonprofit boards you worked on.
Yeah, so I've been on several boards through the years, to name a few. Sojourners Alliance, United Way of Moscow, Latah County, Backyard Harvest, back before Inland Oasis took that over somewhat recently. I've been an executive member of the Latah County Board of Realtors. I've also served on the Moscow Charter School. And I presently serve on the Latah County Library Foundation. I'm actually the president of that. And I serve as the treasurer for the Palouse Clearwater Environmental Institute. I also serve presently on the Fair and Affordable Housing Commission as the secretary. So I've had some civic engagement over the past year or so, been tuning in more to what's been going on at the council level. And with my real estate experience, I've had some minor interfacing with folks at the city here and there, as people have questions about code or property possibilities or zoning. I've handled that on and off for the last 10 years, the last five of which has been as the broker of Blue Sky Real Estate. So that's a company I started December of 2020, and I've been operating that from my home office, and happily just brought on another agent a couple months ago. So now there's two of us at the company, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
So you're still working as a realtor. What are your thoughts about the housing market growth? And it sounds like most realtors around here are selling homes and lots outside the city limits. I could be wrong about that, but that's where the expansion's going. But just give me an overview of what you think about the real estate market growth and, you know, whatever social engineering might be going on.
Yeah, so housing is a need, right? And that's kind of where I always start this conversation. And, you know, part of that need is having a variety of housing supply available to folks for their various at-home needs. And so I personally would love to see, you know, growth in a direction that is more sort of accessible, more affordable, smaller scale. Can't tell you how many times I've had buyers, you know, in that 200 to 350 range that just can't find something affordable and accessible to them. And if or when they do, there's, you know, five others chomping at the bit to get it. And so it's really a challenging situation to be in. I mean, demand in Moscow in the time I've been an agent, you know, since 2016 has just been pretty high. And even in these slower times, you know, market times are still generally in the 45 to 60 days on market. We are starting to see some recent, you know, price reductions and buyers who were able to get closing cost credits and a percentage off of the asking price. That certainly wasn't the case 5 years ago. So, you know, there's been some recent slower activity, but Moscow as a whole is a pretty stable place. And I think that's why a lot of people, you know, love growing up here, decide to raise families here, and participate in the community. It's just a really great place to be.
Now, you're listed as a member of the Moscow Fair and Affordable Housing Commission. Mm-hmm. They recently recommended that the city council start a housing authority. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on a housing authority? You know, how quickly can that get going, and what impact can it have soon?
Yeah, great question. So that's been kind of the foremost topic of the Fair and Affordable Housing Commission since the start of the year. And the thing that excites me most about the housing authority is that as a quasi-governmental entity, it is eligible for grant opportunities for affordable housing projects that aren't necessarily directly available to the city of Moscow. So to me, even as a funding and grant entity, it's a very exciting prospect. I certainly can't speak to the time frame nor the scale that this will kick off. I think that's going to depend largely on the transformation of who's involved, how much time and effort is dedicated to grant writing, you know, and frankly, how much cooperation there is with the city of Moscow. Again, I want to be clear here. The housing authority per Idaho code has to be authorized by a municipality, but it does not fall under the umbrella of the city of Moscow per se. So it kind of operates quasi-governmentally alongside following approval. Housing authorities can, you know, buy, rent out, sell, develop pieces of property and acquire property. You know, the thing that excites me most about this is the way in which the Housing Authority could perhaps partner with the Hills and Rivers Housing Trust, perhaps Habitat for Humanity, perhaps developers looking through sort of conventional routes for more affordable development, whether that be lower income rental opportunities or lower income housing for sale.
And so it sounds like you're saying that the city council can approve and create the housing authority, but it falls under a lot of limitations from the state. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, yes. So the authorization occurs through a municipality. The housing authority last year was approaching the county, mm-hmm. and
the county didn't want to do it, did it?
Correct. So the housing authority working group then approached the city, and we've had a lot of extensive conversations about how to kind of place brackets around this. How do we frame the focus of it so that it's effective and can still be flexible mm-hmm. for future needs? And I think right now there's a lot of excitement around it. There's still, some questions to be answered. But I'm excited about where it's going. I think at this point, the more players there are, the more potential there is for grant money, the more opportunity there is for affordable housing to get built.
Okay. And I just want to, clean up on this housing issue. So you would agree, two of the candidates I've interviewed already have said the biggest issue in Moscow would be workforce housing. So you're talking about workforce housing being the focus of these various entities that are helping out with the housing situation, not so much, maybe we have enough housing stock for wealthier people. I don't know. So let's see. What do you think should be done to help the residents of these six trailer courts in the area that an investment firm purchased? Most are outside the city, but, if they can't afford to stay, then they'll be impacting the rental market here in town. So I guess maybe this is a general question about the rental market and the pressures low-income people are under.
Yeah. So that's been a huge concern of mine for years now. We've seen mobile home parks get purchased by a particular entity, and then the lot rents within those parks escalate pretty steeply.
And they impose rules, and they also cut down their shade trees as sort of a retribution for organizing, I believe.
I honestly don't know, quite enough about what they've been doing. The central topic that's come before residents of these parks coming before the Fair and Affordable Housing Commission has primarily been focused on lot rents and some challenges as well. Regarding maintenance and requirements either within or outside of those lease agreements. But I think a lot of the emphasis on why we need a housing authority and a lot of the initial conversations surrounding it have been about how we can provide more protection for those who really need safe, accessible, affordable, stable, secure housing. I mean, however many adjectives we can use, it is seemingly increasingly paramount to pin down this fair and affordable housing issue.
I imagine one of Idaho's dozens or so local preemption laws is one that prohibits rent control. I'm not sure about that, but I did want to ask about a more general question about local preemption laws, and maybe you can tick off a half dozen or a dozen that you don't agree with, but let's see. There's a couple I've written down: banning vax requirements for entry into venues or for employment, banning mask requirements for local governments or health districts, limiting local taxing authority. The list goes on and on, and maybe you could speak about that and, what city council people can do to lobby the legislature to get a better regulatory environment.
Yeah, I mean, I've always approached the importance of government this way. I think whether local, state, or national, you know, the foremost priority should always be the safety of the constituency, right? The health of the constituency, and the providing of essential services such as public health care, you know, transportation facilities, safe roadways, safe sidewalks, you know, clean, healthy drinking water, kind of all the basics. The fire and EMS services obviously are very essential. So I, you know, in terms of some of these restrictions, I am one who respects and understands a private company's ability to set their own policies. I think that that element of how folks wish to run their businesses is I guess admirable, certainly not always agreeable, but admirable. And I think, you know, our current legal structure, you know, should continue to enable that to some extent. Obviously, withstanding, you know, protections for federally protected classes. And, you know, this is where that intersection between, you know, private rights and public services and the providing of those is really essential. You know, I for one, I'm a huge advocate of public schools and water security, and you know, I think housing extends into this as well. These are things that people need, right? This isn't just things that people want, and these entities need tax revenue, and they need the support of local communities in order to continue to function.
Do you have any thoughts about the way the city handled the pandemic, having a mask ordinance during the pandemic and so forth? It was quite controversial, and there's no guarantee that a pandemic may not come up again.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think city council acted with the best information that was available at the time and provided by public health officials. And to be honest, I think it was the right call to have a mask mandate, to require social distancing. You know, I think that was prior to having vaccines available, prior to knowing more information about how coronavirus was spreading. We really, you know, I think the city was acting in the interest of the public and trying to preserve the health and safety, as I touched on earlier, of the general public.
Okay. Well, the University of Idaho seems to be our biggest industry right now. And I guess this also goes back to local preemption. How should we respond to attacks on education, both from the Idaho administration or the Idaho legislature and the Trump administration? Yeah. We've got Senator Ben Taze's censorship law for higher education, and I believe there's some censorship going on through the legislature on K-12 as well, as, at least as far as like banners and symbols and stuff. But the higher education one is really concerning because it involves what teachers, professors can even talk about. And you know, and once again, this is our biggest industry in the community, so big effect on Moscow.
Yeah. I mean, the University of Idaho is certainly, you know, an economic driver. It's an essential part of what makes Moscow a really cool place to live, right? It's more diverse than a lot of Idaho is. It's more highly educated than many other areas of Idaho are. So, you know, to me, supporting the University of Idaho and having that continuous relationship is essential to quality of life here. I, you know, I'm a UI alum myself, go Vandals, and understand the benefit that's at play there. You know, the challenging trade-off is because when we look at City of Moscow's limits, a lot of City of Moscow property is state-owned property, right? It's the University of Idaho property. And, you know, the city of Moscow doesn't really collect property tax revenue from that, unfortunately. So, you know, there's this trade-off that obviously is for the greater good, and you know, on the balance, is hugely positive. But, you know, there is sort of a trade-off in terms of, you know, the balance sheet for the city of Moscow. You know, to touch on the state's view on education and education funding, you know, I really wish that Idaho prioritized public education funding further, not only K-12, but at our universities. It's something that I look forward to the potential to have conversation with legislators about as a representative of the city of Moscow serving on council. You know, I have some optimism regarding the University of Idaho's, you know, longer term outlook. I know things are extremely challenging right now, not only federally, but at the state level. I do have longer term hopes and ambitions for how Idaho can better serve K-12 and public universities.
Okay. I want to touch on one other issue before we wrap up, and that's usually asked at most of these forums, is your thoughts about the water supply. It seems like the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee is starting to focus on one particular solution, bringing water up from the Clearwater. What are your thoughts about that solution, and how do you navigate all this? You know, it seems like our water supply is across the state line. How do you navigate all the regulatory issues?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Briefly.
it's a complicated issue, right? And it's one that is so essential. You know, we can't have community growth. That was a central theme of the Chamber of Commerce Forum, right? Last month was, you know, hey, candidates, how do you view growth in Moscow? Where do you think it's going? What are priorities for you? And for me, water security is the priority. You do not have civilization without water, right? And the status of the Palouse Basin Aquifer, and with the nature of the geography and geology of the Palouse and how Moscow is situated relative to that basin, us being on the eastern edge of it and kind of in the shallow end, it makes this situation especially challenging for Moscow. Most of that Palouse Basin is in the state of Washington, and so collaborative solutions oftentimes include asking for Washington to put a lot more money into a water supply that's secondary to the aquifer. I generally am in favor of the direction that this proposal is going with the Clearwater River, and I think there's been enough time dedicated to the research of that topic by locals and experts that honestly I trust that's the essential way to go, and I would love to see it happen while I'm on council.
Yeah, we're still in the feasibility study phase, I believe. Finally, I just want to ask, are there any topics that I haven't brought up that voters might want to hear about? And we'll probably have other forums coming up later, but, you know, anything that maybe hasn't been mentioned yet?
Yeah, goodness. You know, the League of Women Voters Forum is always one that is pretty well attended. I always look forward to that forum because the questions tend to be fairly direct and you know, open-ended, but also somewhat closed off. You know, it might look something like, do you believe X and X should happen, yes or no, and why? And I think those sorts of questions help voters decide and differentiate between candidates. And I frankly am a very open book, so, you know, happy to have conversations with folks regarding any topic from potholes on their block to, you know, greater conversations about long-term issues on the Palouse. I care deeply about this community, and, you know, my wife and I are about to start a family, and for us, you know, the long-term success of the Palouse is critical.
Sage Makedich, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was our interview with Moscow City Council candidate Sage Makedich. It took place at the KRFP studios this afternoon. There are 8 candidates running for 3 open seats on the Moscow City Council. They are Steve Bonner, Evan Holmes, Sage Makedich, Gary Skuland, John Slagboom, Ben Stellman, Scott Sumner, and incumbent Gina Taruscio. The top 3 vote-getters in the 8-way race will win 4-year terms on the council. The council members whose terms are ending are Julia Parker, Haley Lewis, who is running for mayor, and Gina Taruscio, who is running for re-election to the council. The city council members who have 2 years remaining in their terms are Bryce Blankenship, Drew Davis, and Sandra Kelly. There are also 2 candidates running for Moscow mayor, city council member Haley Lewis and Alex Simon. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. We'll be back in a moment.
The Latah Recovery Center is a community of peer support for people dealing with addiction and mental health issues. Located at 531 South Main Street in downtown Moscow, the Latah Recovery Center offers a resource room, rotating calendar of life skills classes, mentoring for those beginning recovery, and telephone recovery services for those who can't make it into the center. All services are free. Find the Latah Recovery Center on Facebook for more information.
The Moscow City Council had 2 agenda items at last night's meeting dealing with city employee work hours. The council approved a change in the city's light-duty work policy, increasing the maximum time for light duty for employees who are injured either on or off the job from 60 days to 6 months. In each case, the city employee's healing status would be evaluated every 30 days or upon receipt of a doctor's note. Moscow Human Resources Manager Sharon Games presented the resolution.
The city's current light duty policy is, it currently allows for a maximum of 60 days for an employee to be on light duty per the policy. And when we have, we've recently done some research to determine what other municipalities are doing in our area, as well as some research on how long it takes to heal for certain types of injuries. And so the conclusion of our research is the recommendation to extend the duration of the light duty policy from 60 days to 6 months with review at 30-day intervals.
The council voted unanimously to make the change in the light duty policy for employees. The council also heard a report from City Supervisor Bill Belknap on a pilot program this summer to implement a 4-day, 10-hour-per-day weekly work schedule during the summer for certain city employees.
On June 2nd of this year, the council authorized an 8-week summer office hours pilot for our city business offices. So that would constitute 4 10-hour workdays for the course of the week, with city business offices closed on Fridays. Now, we did have some variation that happened during that time period. We did want to make sure that we had building inspection services available 5 days a week. During that time period, from the 30th through August 22nd, city business offices were open from 7 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday and closed on Fridays. Employees had a unpaid 30-minute lunch break to make that 10-hour workday, to fulfill our 40-hour work week. It's very similar to, again, a lot of offices at the University of Idaho sometimes shift to summer office hours, as does the administrative offices for the school district during the summer months. We notify the public through our website, social media posts. We had postings on all office buildings a month leading up to the pilot with an email that we provided for any comments or concerns the public might have. We did not receive any.
Dunlap said city staff surveyed employees after the pilot program was done for the year.
We asked, what benefits did you experience while working the 410 schedule this year? So the largest, the most frequent response was better work-life balance. So 56 respondents indicated that. 44% indicated increased productivity. 41 of the respondents identified improved morale. 29 respondents indicated having fewer commutes, because we do have a large number of employees that either live Lewiston, Troy, Deary, or outlying rural areas. And then another 18 identified just other category of benefits. We also asked, what challenges do they face working that 410 schedule? The greatest response, so 39 of the respondents indicated none. The next highest was 21 respondents indicated just fatigue during long shifts, you know, longer days. We had 12 employees indicate impact on personal commitments. Another 12 that indicated other, and those were in the kind of detailed comments. And then a few that indicated they felt there was potentially reduced collaboration or difficult managing workload during that shorter work week. We asked if there did the productivity change while working the 410 schedule. So 53% of respondents indicated they felt their productivity improved during that concentrated week. 46 indicated it stayed the same, and one respondent indicated they thought it declined. Well, we asked, what did they perceive to be changes in customer or client service? So 71% of respondents indicated they did not feel that there was any change to customer service. 17% actually felt it was positive having some of the extended office hours, and we did have 12% indicate they thought it was potentially a negative to customer service.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Bill Belknap. Council members were positive about the report and indicated the city might continue with the program next summer. Here's City Council Member Julia Parker.
I think it was a great program. I think anything that doesn't cost us any money and makes city employees happier is a win.
The council accepted the report on the summer 4-day, 10-hour work schedule. And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. Mostly clear through Thursday, low 41 tonight, highs 73 tomorrow and Thursday, low 45 Wednesday night. Partly cloudy, low 44 Thursday night. And a 30% chance of showers Friday, partly sunny, high 70. Currently, we have 61 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP.org website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. That also applies to nonprofits. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartas. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Flashpoints is coming up next. And that'll be followed at 7:30 with Rude Awakening live in the studios, going on till 9:30. And at 9:30, Music in Earnest with Brent Bent, with the Brent Bent Show. And at 10 o'clock, we'll have Sons of Patriarchy, a brand new episode featuring an interview with Emily Dye, who has just gone international in coverage of her abuse under Logos School in Moscow, Idaho. And that is, she ended up in the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and also Der Spiegel, a magazine in Germany. And we'll be able to hear the Sons of Patriarchy interview with Emily Dye tonight at 11 o'clock. It'll be repeated Saturday at 2 p.m. if you can't stay up that late. And also coming up on Flashpoint, we'll have the Elections Crimes Bulletin with Greg Palast. So stay tuned. That's coming up almost immediately. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of North Central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
KRFP, Moscow is the best in the USA. Yeah.